certainly. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. We have on the call today John Nevitt, Mark Partridge, Faye Jamil.
Excuse me, Paul McGrady now joins.
Alan Greenberg, Olivier Tratin-Leblanc, Kurt Pritt, Konstantinos Komatis, Kathy Kleiman, Jeffrey Eckhaus, David Maher, Paul McGrady. And for staff, we have Margie Milam, Amy Statoff, Liz Gaster, and Kurt Pritz, whom I mentioned previously, and Glenda Sanjavi. Thank you, David. Over to you.
Okay, thank you. I can now see the screen, so we're back in business. The first issue is the mandatory issue. Last time we moved that to the end. Does anyone feel strongly about doing that again, or can we?
Yes,
are we
please.
Close to
Kathy, if we could move it to the end, that would be great. We're really close,
okay.
But thanks.
Okay, I'll accept that suggestion. We'll move it right on then to the elements of the complaint. Who wants to open the discussion on that? Mark?
Thank you. We had a very productive call this week, and I think what we have a consensus on, and I would say certainly in principle, is that the statement of elements within the URS policy would be the UDRP elements supplemented with the section of the nominet elements that specify what, for lack of better term, we've called the safe harbors for registrants. The reason we've tried to do this is that, you know, both the UDRP and the nominet are known quantities rather than coming up with something new that might have unintended loopholes. And the value of the nominet safe harbors is that they address issues that were not addressed or not foreseen, you know, 10 years ago or more than 10 years ago when the UDRP was created, but reflect what the case law in courts and what the cases that have come out of the UDRP in dealing with various issues. And then finally, I think referencing the nominate factors is probably useful in indicating that this is not just a totally U.S.-centric point of view. So
okay.
I think with that, we came to agreement on that principle, and we've circulated a draft. There might be some slight wordsmithing left on that draft, but I believe we also have, at least broad consensus on that within our working group, and Kathy can certainly, comment and confirm or deny what I've said.
Okay, Kathy.
I actually agree with everything Mark said and appreciate him presenting and appreciate everyone's time on Wednesday getting together and really thinking about the UDRP and nominet. Just wanted to add the little factor that the current version, I believe, is the one Jeff Newman circulated with some revisions to the text, and that would be the one we might want to post if that's possible. But this was a group effort, and it really, I think, creates a balance within the URS and something people can refer to, examiners can refer to make quick, rapid decisions.
Okay, we have a document up on the screen now. Is that the correct version?
Yeah, I put it in Newman's version. So.
Yeah. So if I could go back and just comment on what everybody's seen, the first paragraph, second paragraph, and third paragraph are the existing UDRP elements. So, you know, that's the known quantity that people are comfortable with. Then when you go below that, you have a section headed safe harbor. That may not be the right way to phrase this in the formal document, but the concept is there. And then these elements come from the nominet policy.
Mark, may I add, they come from Section 4 of the nominet policy titled How the Respondent May Demonstrate in Its Response That the Domain Name Is Not an Abusive Registration.
That might be a good phrase for to replace the safe harbor word, something along that. Well, I guess it's there. Yeah.
Okay, Zahid.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that even the BC supports this approach. I think this is a great effort that we on that call trying to get this done, and we would also support it. I particularly think the language we saw, which is up there now, Jeff's, is very useful and would support that one as a final version. I think there's some wordsmithing. I agree with Mark, but pretty much this is fine with us.
Okay, thank you. Then I think we can move on. We'll have to go back to the straw man proposal.
Hold on a second. Sorry. Okay. Stop sharing.
Okay, that brings us to the format of the complaint. I believe we have had consensus on that. There's no comment. We can move along to the standard for evaluation. This is what I believe formerly was known as Rule 56. Do we have, Zahid, I think you were working on this. Do we have a document, or do you want to speak to
Yes. Thank you, David. Yes, a document. I tried to work on some language, then Konstantinos has made some changes to that, slight ones, and I think his version is the final one. We both agree on it, and if anybody has any comments, that would be fair to take them up right now.
Mark?
It's there, yeah.
Yeah, I'd just add that I think this is good, and I support it.
Okay, fine. In that case, back to the straw man, and we'll move along.
So there's consensus on this as well. I just want to clarify that.
Yes, as I understand it, I don't see any hands raised.
Great. That's great work, guys.
Oh, Zahid?
Oh, no, that was just an applause. Sorry, I'm taking it down.
Okay. So we need the straw man again. The speed of light has slowed down a bit today. Oh, well. Okay.
It is Friday.
Yeah, that's true. It's motive notice. We've all long time. We've had consensus on that.
David, I'm sorry.
Mark, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I guess I would like to go back to the last thought and have a what I hope might be a friendly amendment to the language that I missed the first time. There's a point at where it says that the evidence shows that it is an infringing domain name. And I'm not
sure. Do you want me to pull that back up so you can see it?
Yeah, and I think infringing is the wrong word in that spot. If you go down sort of toward the section begins that if the examiner it begins this means that the complainant
okay yeah I think I've said it so you all can scroll yourselves
yes and I, this the phrase being used abusively to infringe the trademark. I would suggest it's being used abusively in violation of this policy.
Just in point A at the beginning, I think yesterday we changed substantial validation to substantial something else. Whatever it is, we should be consistent.
That's
Reddit.
True.
I don't remember what word we used, but I think we changed it from validation to something else.
Substantial review.
Review, okay.
Thank you. Zahid, did you want to comment on the marks?
I just wanted to say that we absolutely agree with that.
Is there any disagreement with that?
So it's Liz. Being used abusively in violation of the policy, or are you proposing more different language?
That's the language I'm proposing.
Okay, thanks.
And the reason behind it is that infringed, of course, is a legal issue that is different from the, although very much overlapping, is different than the issue here.
Oh, Kathy?
Hello.
I want to go back to that in a second because I'm pulling up the UDRP policy. But I think the term was substantive review, not substantial review.
You're right. It is substantive.
And Mark, let me comment. The evidence that the domain name was registered and being used in violation of the policy isn't the UDRP term is being used in bad faith, right?
Yes.
Was registered, and the evidence that the domain name was registered
and is being used in bad faith.
Can we go back to the language?
Used in bad faith in violation of the policy.
Okay.
Isn't that a circular definition?
Yeah.
That doesn't matter. In violation of the policy ties it down to this policy.
Okay.
There might be an abuse that was outside the policy.
So registered, being used in bad faith, and being used abusively against the policy.
Well, bad faith. And
is being used abusively in violation of the policy, period.
No, I'm trying to put back in the words and
you
is
like
being
it,
used
in
bad
faith.
Faith.
So is being used in bad faith in violation of the policy?
Oh, okay.
Great. Thank you.
Yep. I'm okay with that. I think that was.
Go ahead.
Do we want? Sorry.
Sorry. Thank you, David. Just wanted to point out, Mark, there's further down in on the next page as well. There are two instances where infringing or actually non-infringing is being used. Is that all right, would you like to sort of look at that as well?
No, in the first context where it says the use of the domain name in question is a non-infringing or fair use of the trademark, that's appropriate, I think. And the next section is non-infringing. Yes, because
okay.
the thing is that that infringing is sweeps in more than a violation of this policy. But if it is non-infringing, it is not within the policy.
Thank you.
Thanks. Margie.
Oh, I just had a point about do we want to refer to it as a policy? In the UDRP, it made sense to refer to it as a policy, but something else, the implementation rules.
Whatever it turns out to be called is what we should call it.
Okay. I don't know what I'm calling it yet, but I'll put something in the report and you guys can comment.
Okay.
Would this procedure be good?
I don't like procedure that well.
The process?
process?
We'll mull over it. But.
How about the URS?
That's probably a good suggestion.
This is a violation of the URS.
And violation of the URS.
Yeah, that works.
Okay. Then back to the straw man, unless anyone else...
No, not yet.
But Alan?
Yeah, we have the examiner... We had the examiner must, and now it's the examiner should. Is there a rationale for changing must to should? Where is that, Alan? Just after A, B, C, D. First read in the document. Almost the first read.
An interesting question. Kathy, do you have your hand up?
Not on this issue, so I'll be happy to wait until this is resolved.
I'm not sure of the reason for changing that word there.
No.
I wonder if the reason was to give the examiner some level of leeway. I don't know how that word changed.
Yeah, neither do I. It seems to me that must is more appropriate in this context.
Do we remember who did this? Who did this rework?
I think Jeff Newman.
Sorry, this is Zahid.
And
that was me. No, sorry, that's fine. It was me, and if it needs to go back to must, but one of the reasons was to give some sort of scope to the examiner, but if there's consensus to bring it back to must, that's fine. I would have thought shall would be better instead of must, but should is gives the slight bit of leeway to the examiner, but it's up to the discretion of the...
I like shall.
Shall is a good word there, shall. Yes.
Yeah. Any objection to shall? I don't care. Okay, then we'll change it to shall. Okay, any other issues on the... Kathy, you have your hand up?
Yes, thank you. There was... It's something I'd like to move from the URS elements document that the group that I was part of created, and I think it belongs properly here. And I just wanted to share, I know we can't have both documents up at once, so let me read it. It was the very end of the document we circulated. And it said, our text was, the following shall be added by ICANN staff to the URS policy as additional guidance to the URS examiner. This is a direct quotation from the IRT report. And it's just the instruction that where there is any genuine contestable issue as to whether a domain name registration in use is an abusive use of a trademark, the complaint will be denied, terminating the URS process without prejudice to further action, e.g., a UDRP or court proceeding. The URS is not intended for use in any questionable proceedings, but only clear cases of trademark abuse. And I'd like to recommend that paragraph, which has kind of been hanging out in limbo, be added to this section.
Any objection to that?
No, it overlaps slightly with the last paragraph we have right now, but we don't need to do final wordsmithing here. So I have no problem moving it.
Okay.
Excuse me, it's Liz. Can you just state where it's getting moved from so I can capture it?
Absolutely. Being? This is the Jeff Newman. He was the last one to edit it. The URS elements and examination document,
thanks.
Final paragraph.
Okay.
And where are we moving it to?
The end of the document currently up on the screen.
Okay.
Then back to the straw man.
All right.
All right. We've now moved down to contents, notice contents, and I believe we have consensus on that. The effect of filing complaint.
Yeah. David, on it's Alan on notice. I think the language wording needs to be refined, but we don't need to do it here. And I'll look carefully at whatever Margie produces and comment at that point.
Okay. Then moving along to the effect of filing the complaint. Any comments on that? Moving along then, the time to answer. We have consensus with, can we have consensus on the IPC tying it to maintaining expedited commencement? Is that an agreed upon element, or is that still a separate view? I don't see any hands raised, so let's make that the full consensus. Moving along then to the commencement of evaluation, we appear to have consensus there. Again, moving along to the number of examiners, there's consensus. Then we get to the assignment of examiners, where we may still have an issue. It's a non-commercial issue. Kathy, do you or Constantinos?
I think we were waiting for staff to report back.
Ah. Mark, could you...
Yeah, I believe it's the case within the STI that we have a consensus on how this would work, and the only remaining concern is the one voiced by the staff that there might... that current providers might not be happy with this.
Yeah, I think that's correct.
But I think we should still make the recommendation as to what we view as the appropriate thing to have happen.
Kathy?
Ask the providers to comply.
And I think the straw man, I think whoever phrased this, I thought did it very, very well. The principal is right. They've captured it. The provider required to work with all certified examiners with reasonable exceptions, and I'll skip the parentheses, to avoid cherry-picking of examiners that are likely to rule in a certain way. And that's exactly that's exactly the point. That's exactly the goal. So I appreciate that being captured so clearly.
Okay, good. If there's nothing else on that, we'll move along to evaluation.
So we have full consensus on that.
I'd like to add one more thought that I think we've discussed and had consensus on that's not completely reflected here, is that required to work with all certified examiners with reasonable exceptions. We've talked about two kinds of exceptions. One is exceptions based on language and jurisdiction, and the other is for malfeasance, and we might want to reflect that.
Good point.
This is Amy. May I speak to that as well?
Sure.
And I think both of those are fine, Mark. I also think, though, we do need to just leave in the option, as it does say, that staff is, you know, going to be communicating with the providers to see if they identify, you know, the options that they want to use to not work with somebody that may not be deemed specifically malfeasance. You know, it just depends on how you define malfeasance.
How about with reasonable exceptions, for example?
Yeah, I think that's probably good. And again, we'll certainly start, you know, we are going to be exploring this, and, you know, if things come up that really seem like the providers are just not going to be any give, we'll certainly come back. But I think if they have the reasonable option to deny because of some past history or current history, I think that should work.
Okay. Kathy?
Great. No, that answered my question. Thank you.
Okay. In that case, we'll move along to the evaluation on the merits, or it appears we have consensus. Then we get to remedy, if successful on the merits. Paul, you did some work on this. Do you want to address this?
Sure. Sorry, sorry about that. I couldn't figure out where my mute button was. I took a look at the CSC report, and we wanted to look at that data about which successful complainants kept domain names and which didn't. And, you know, there was a significant fraction that either did not renew them and they are eligible now for re-registration, or they did not renew them and they've been registered by some third party. I think it was like 15%. It was certainly less than 20% of folks who did that. And so I don't know what that tells us other than most people who've used the UDRP take full advantage of the transfer protocol, but not everybody. So, again, I don't know how it informs the debate, but it was interesting to track down.
Yeah, thank you. Alan?
Yeah, I just wanted I think we should probably break this into two because we do have consensus on what it says in the straw man proposal. We don't have consensus whether there should be an additional option of transfer.
Yeah, I think you're right on that. Any comments on that, Zahid?
I think that's a good approach, and I think it would highlight also the transfer issue, so that's fine by me.
Okay, we're still not in agreement, I gather, on the transfer possibility.
This is Zahid. Yeah, I mean, from the BC's perspective, this is something we would, as we said, it was defined as a gating issue.
Kathy, were you leading the other approach to that? Is there still a disagreement?
Yes, I'm afraid there is still a strong disagreement on this, and I'd urge others to speak as well. And that is going back to the principles of the URS and what the URS was created for, and that all along we had understood this as a suspension mechanism and not a replacement to the UDRP. And the distinction is a very valuable one. It was a distinction in the IRT, and it's a distinction we think is critical to maintain here as well.
Okay. John?
Yes, thanks. One point, I don't think we have consensus on that last sentence. I think there was some dispute. That was offered as a compromise between the two proposals, one being the IRT proposal where there's no transfer, it just goes through the regular deletion cycle and expiration cycle, and the proposal that the BC is pushing on transfer. So that was a middle ground position offered try to reach both sides.
John, are you talking about the extension?
Yeah, I'm talking about the extension.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, exactly. So I would say that has consensus. That was offered as a compromise, and it had some folks aren't sure if that is the right compromise or not. So that's related to what's being discussed.
Okay. Alan?
Yeah, two things. Number one, that was I'm the one who put that in, and that was not offered as a compromise. That was put in to cover the case where the domain is expiring just around about the time that the URS is being handled. And
Alan, I put that in the straw man when we first put it in.
Okay, then I take back the attribution of. But I know I certainly mentioned it, and it has been mentioned a number of times, to cover the case, just like there's a provision in the UDRP for the complainant to extend the life to make sure it doesn't expire and weird things happen to it while the process is going on. It does also serve to extend the life, which is, you know, partially addresses the transfer issue. My main point was from our point of view, we can live with it either way as long as it's reasonably implementable, and if there is a transfer, it's not done so soon that the registrant loses the ability to come in with a late response. Other than that, it's not really a major issue to us.
Okay, Mark?
I agree with Alan's point of view on this, but I think it is an important issue that we should support. It's not the position of the IRT, that's correctly said, but from a dispute resolution and efficiency point of view, most of the cases that go through the UDRP the URS are also going to be clear violations of the UDRP, and it's inefficient and to the system as a whole to then require additional time and expense. I think Alan's suggestion that transfer after a reasonable period for appeal, if none is taken, after 60 days, 90 days, whatever.
Or expiration.
That would make sense. That then it could be transferred. That would be a more efficient cost dispute resolution system and a good approach for this to take, in my personal view.
Okay. Zahid?
Sorry, yes. I think that for us, the extension has two purposes. One that Alan mentioned, because it needs to be extended for, in case it's going to expire anyway. So it needs to be there. But it's a bare minimum. What we're discussing is whether there should be a full transfer. So our position is that's a bare minimum, which we understand. I think it has to be there. But what we're requesting is a transfer provision option. So looking at the statistics that were mentioned earlier by Paul, some of them want to transfer, some of them don't. Given the option, that's what we're suggesting.
Okay. Jeff Eckhaus.
Okay. First off, I'm trying to figure out, I guess, from Mark's statement where he's, where you're saying most of the URS cases are going to be clear violations and certain things are going to happen. We don't have any of this. We don't know. And I think you can't make the assumption because certain UDRP cases are a certain way that URS cases are going to be a certain way because they're completely different. As we see, well, what the idea is that there would be completely different ways of fighting the trademark infringement. So we can't make an assumption that every URS case is going to be clear infringement. So they're going to win the UDRP. So let's just assume they're going to win. They're going to get the transfer anyway. So let's just hand it to them in the first place. So I caution against making statements about what the URS is going to be and what the claims are going to be like. And the other part here is I think I'm still trying to understand from the people who are really pro the transfer here. If we have the UDRP in place, why is it so critical that the transfer happens in the URS? Or is this just saying, hey, we want to get the domain. Here's a quick way of doing it so we don't have to go through the policy that's currently in place. To me, it's like, hey, let's have a shortcut to get the domain transferred to us. Instead of going to the UDRP, we could just do this a lot quicker in the URS and get the domain to us. If we have the UDRP and the transfer option, why is it so critical that we have the URS, where if somebody wants the name in a transfer, they can file the UDRP after, the name is suspended and the trademark infringement has been taken down?
Well, the quick answer to that is that the UDRP is far more expensive. But, Paul, go ahead.
Can I propose a compromise and suggest that we have a transfer option only after the domain name in dispute goes past its expiration date so that it's not re-released to the wild for re-registration? And at that point, the brand owner say that they would like to take transfer of the domain name.
Paul, it's Jeff. Can you repeat that one more time? I'm sorry. I missed part of that. Can you please repeat that?
Sure. It's a transfer option that only kicks in if that domain name goes past its expiration date. In other words, if the losing respondent in a URS proceeding fails to renew it. That way, the domain name remains inactive through its lifespan, and then at the end of its lifespan, instead of being released for re-registration by any third party, the brand owner can exercise its option to transfer at that time.
Okay, Mark.
I think Paul's has a useful suggestion there. We do have a problem that's been identified as the revolving door problem, and it would be good for us to find a solution to that and not just ignore it. The other point I wanted to make, I guess you've made, David, is my particular concern, Jeff, about having the added transfers, not to prejudge how these cases are going to come out, but that, you know, if in the event that there are cases that are clear cut and are going to be violations of both, it's more efficient and cost effective to have the option of the transfer remedy at some point in the process without having the added burden of expense that David described. That's my point.
Okay. Konstantinos.
Yes. I feel uncomfortable with the transfer for the simple reason that we're not asking the panel to deliberate on whether the domain name should be transferred or not. In 3 days, we're asking the panel to deliberate on whether the domain name should be suspended or not. Under the UDRP, this is a very transfer is based on a very substantive review of what is happening. Needless to say that we are assuming that once the domain name goes into the pool and is re-registered, we are working under the presumption that the new registrant is going to be a bad actor, which we don't know, and it's not necessarily the case. So I think that we have the UDRP, which, yes, in comparison to the URS, might be more expensive, but it's still relatively cheap. So if a trademark owner really wants to get transfer of the domain name, he or she should have the opportunity to go back to the UDRP and claim the transfer. Thank you.
Okay. Zahid.
Hi, sorry. I'm trying to propose something. In case of a situation where a respondent does not answer and there's a default, what could happen is that then you, if you want the domain name, you have to file the UDRP. And then that respondent would probably file an answer in the UDRP. I see that is a slight problem because if you're looking at summary judgment proceedings, you don't give a respondent a second chance to file an answer. Usually it's sort of, you know, they either file an answer or they didn't. If they default, you move on. And then once you do the trial, if there is any or isn't, you actually have a judgment at the end of it. So here, let me propose this. What if we were to add the further safeguard in what Paul has suggested, which is that in case there's no default and there has been an answer, the transfer option would not exist. But in cases where there was a default of filing an answer, then the option of transfer would exist.
Could you repeat that?
So in cases where the respondent doesn't file an answer at all, ever, and there is default, and he's not interested, it doesn't make sense if you file another UDRP and give him another chance to file an answer. So I would like to make a distinction between cases where there's been default in filing an answer in URS, and if there's been a default, the transfer option should exist. And if there hasn't been a default, fine, then the trademark holder has to go the second round and do a UDRP.
I, from a legal standpoint, I see some problems with that. The two procedures, URS and UDRP, are different. It's not as if there's a single cause of action in a court. I have to say I'm not persuaded by that argument. But, Robin, you have your hand up.
Yeah, thanks. I have a problem with it as well. First of all, these evaluators are going to be evaluating based on one person's use. So now if you're saying we're going to transfer that domain name such that nobody else can have it based upon one bad actor's misuse, doesn't seem fair at all because the next person's rights are not being considered here. The next person's intended use are not being considered here, and that's what's being taken away, the next person's rights and ability to be able to register that domain name if you give an automatic transfer based upon one guy's misuse. So I feel like we're not thinking about this properly because the evaluation is always going to be based upon this particular use. And so you can't decide all the other uses are going to be bad based upon this one use being bad. That's all.
Okay, Kathy.
Robin has made the point that I was thinking of as well, that We're envisioning here the discussion is about the good faith complainants. Well, what about the bad faith complainants? Does the URF become a quick and easy way to game the system to get ordinary dictionary words based on a trademark for a generic term that may be generic in some uses and may be trademarked in other uses? And this becomes a quick way to get it, and that's not what the URF was intended for. In fact, if I remember correctly, and correct me if I'm wrong, I thought that the IRT even envisioned the ability of a registrant to correct the website, to take down something that was infringing. Jeff Eckhouse had used the example of somebody putting up a Rolex model, believing that because they were selling Rolexes, they could use that logo and a related domain name. We don't have any opportunity for correction here. These domain names get suspended for the remainder of their period, which could be, you know, 10 years. Again, I think, what about the bad faith complaint? The other thing I wanted to raise, David, was that I don't think we're at an end here. This is really a beginning. We're rapidly creating a new process, and as we envision it, there will be review. There's unfortunately not going to be sunset, but there's going to be review, there's going to be evaluation, and hopefully there's going to be a PDP with integration of the URS and the UDRP, and that would seem to me the right time to integrate the full range of remedies.
Okay. I think we're rapidly approaching a point where it's clear there is lack of consensus, and whatever happens, we're going to see separate opinions, separate positions filed. We have two. Well, now it's Alan's hand up. Alan, do you have something further to say?
Yes, I do. Sorry. Two quick comments. Number one, Robin's statement saying that we shouldn't take a domain name away on one use doesn't really hold water, because that's exactly what the UDRP does. So I think there is a precedent for that, should we choose to do it. The second is, I'll suggest another alternative. What about a transfer provision, let's say, at the end of the domain life, if this is the second successful URS with that domain name? Does that address some of the problems that people have?
It's Jeff Eckhouse here. Let me just jump in and just say that technically that becomes a nightmare scenario. You'd have to build a huge amount of functionality into the domain and say, oh, it's got, you know, like one URS against it. It's got a second. Then this would happen. That would be an enormous amount of work for that.
I don't agree. I think both the combination of the URS provider and the trademark holder can easily provide that evidence.
Oh, they could provide the evidence, but what happens is, from a technical standpoint, having to build that functionality in and to know what would happen, say, if this is a second URS, then it would be transferred. You would have to be up to the URS provider to affect that transfer to make sure it happens. It would be, I don't know if you'd be able to do that, say, for the cost that we decided that we'd be able to do that.
Hey, Zahid?
I would agree with Alan. I don't understand the technical issue there, because the point is that as long as there is an arbitration award, effectively that's what it is. If a U.S. provider issues an order saying, "Well, this is a second repeat offense, and so the remedy is hereby allowed," that is exactly what is done in a UDRP, where a dispute resolution provider panelist issues that sort of decision. So I don't see the technicality issue; you're just complying with the order.
So let me clear that up. It would be, I guess, I'll just to clarify that. It would be a huge amount of manual work to do it, and I'd say you could do it manually, and you couldn't build it in technically, but then the point is it would become a huge amount of manual labor, and then would the URS providers and the others be able to still do this at the low cost that they wanted, that it wanted to be done? And then they're saying, and then the thought is, hey, if we have to do all this manual labor for transfers, we're going to have to raise our prices, and then suddenly becomes the same price as the UDRP. So that's what I was saying on the technical part, that it would be a huge amount of work to build technical if you wanted to take away the manual part of it.
Yeah. Can I respond to that?
Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, that's fine. If there were a lot of UDRPs, because there are going to be a lot of new GTLDs, a lot more UDRPs and a lot more decisions, you're still faced with the same administrative manual problem. So I'm having difficulty seeing the distinction.
John, I have a comment, I believe. I agree with Jeff. I think there is a real issue about the amount of work that would need to be done to accomplish that from my personal knowledge of registrar operations. Mark, you have your hand up.
Well, my thought was that Jeff mentioned that there would be additional cost. I think that the cost would be at the election of the brand owner who chooses to take that remedy, and there could be a surcharge for that. And I would think the surcharge would be cheaper than having to go through the UDRP process. So overall, it would be a cost-effective way to deal with this.
Okay. I don't see any other hands raised. I think I'll go back to my statement that we need separate statements. I don't think we're anywhere close to a consensus on this. Mark?
I'm looking at the language that's on the screen where it says there's a consensus on the remedy and consensus on straw man proposal except for extension. What I was hearing is that we do have a consensus on the extension, unless I've missed something.
Kathy?
I was thinking exactly the same thing as I read through the notes as well. We have no objection to the extension and understand the reasons for it, that there may be other actions in case, as I understood the rationale for the extension, in case it's close to the expiration period of the domain name, the complainant might want to extend so that they have other options, including
okay.
court and UDRP.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Then let's, John. Moving along, then, the next box is the effect of filing answer after default. And are there any further comment on that? Okay, then we come to the appeal decision. And I think the issue, well, looking at this, I'm not sure whether there is still an issue. Do we have any comments on this? Kathy.
The only issue that we still had was taking, we had agreed to take the question of fees back to our group, and we agree, as you would all expect, the appellant should pay for the appeal.
Is there any objection to that? Well, can we declare, I take it then we can declare a consensus.
You've got hands raised, I think.
Pardon?
You've got some hands raised.
John, I think those were left over.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, well then we can move along to the evaluation of appeal, and I think we have consensus there. Kathy?
Except that I think it was a recommendation that both options be available. So let me recommend some wording, if I might, that the URS provider shall have a standing three-person, instead of panel, because that's confusing with UDRP, let's call it the appeal board. So starting over, the URS provider shall have a standing three-person appeal board or three panelists, one appointed, and then no change to the rest of the language, one appointed by each of the parties. So the URS provider shall have a standing three-person panel, the wording is, and also offer the option of a party-selected appeal board with one person appointed by each of the parties, as follows.
Okay, Mark?
I'm wondering, Kathy, do we really need to say that they have to have the three-panel appeal board? I thought what we were saying is you have to do one of either of these, but you don't have to do both.
I thought we had talked about this at length last time. It's very important to us from a registrant perspective. Going out and finding panelists is very, very difficult. I get contacted about this all the time. It's difficult. It's time-consuming. And so having the standing three-person panel is much more consistent with the rapid process that we're trying to do under the URF.
Kathy, who would do the choice of either or?
The appellant.
Okay. I guess.
Hey, Constantinos.
Yes, just to add on what Kathy was saying about the standing three-person panel, this is the experience of Nominate as well. They have an internal appeals process, and the panel is always the same. So I would like to offer that as a recommendation to the group.
Amy.
Yeah, just a clarification. I'm wondering if it's just three people and those three people never change, or could it possibly be a larger group of people that then rotate, say, maybe 20 or something like that? I'm just trying to give some flexibility when we talk to the providers about having these panels. If anybody has any thoughts on that.
That seems like a good practical suggestion. Kathy?
The original idea had been to have kind of a balanced panel of different perspectives. I don't know if there's still consensus on that, but a person with extensive trademark law experience, a person with extensive trademark law experience coming in from the fair use perspective, maybe mostly registrant experience, and then it had been posed as an academic or even a very senior technical person. As a third person. So kind of not just any three people, but expertise, and I think you definitely have to take into account language. So I like that idea of perhaps having a larger pool, but something that could be put together very, very quickly and very, very balanced.
Yeah, I think there was some consensus that was enormously complex. But, Mark?
I'd say, you know, having a pool of people who are a standing panel, that seems okay. If there's the option to do the selecting of the party, sort of the AAA, American Arbitration Association method, if the appellant has the option of one or the other, that to me seems reasonable. But I agree with you, David, that trying to identify and put people into certain categories of qualifications, I think is not something that we have a consensus on. I don't support it.
Right, Alan.
Yeah, I was going to say that the a single three-person panel is not likely to be practical. It's not going to be a full-time job, and therefore one has to worry about availability at any given instance. So, working from some larger pool, and we need some words to describe that is probably a much better concept.
Zahid.
Thank you, David. I was just thinking a regular, as Mark mentioned, a regular arbitration mechanism where the parties get to choose. There's a pool of people, and they can look up their CVs and look up their expertise, and that expertise is available so they can read it. And so if it's, say, a registrant or a free speech activist, they know that a certain person has a certain qualification, et cetera, or maybe a bent mind, they can pick them. And that's probably what a lot of people do in commercial arbitrations. So rather than the dispute resolution provider categorizing them, or saying that we will appoint the people, you know, one as a technical, one as a trademark attorney, and one as a free speech attorney, et cetera. Let it be up to the parties to do so, and, you know, there can be one sort of person that, an umpire, et cetera.
Okay. Kathy, do you have your hand up?
No, I'm sorry. Let me take it down.
Okay.
Appreciate the discussion and like the option of either or. As both being available to the appellant, let me put it that way, and the appellant having the choice. So the nominate model or the American Arbitration Association model.
Okay. Then we can move along to the abusive process. Any further comments on that? Alan?
We've talked a lot about the abuse by the claimants, by the mark holder. We haven't talked very much about whether we need something on abuse of the registrant side. And although the registrant is not the one who can be prohibited from filing a URS because they aren't the ones who do it, we can play with fees and things like that to address it. For instance, we've said there should be no additional fee for a late registration, for a late reply. On the other hand, if someone is continually being cited in URSs and they always strategically have a late reply because they get more, you know, pay-per-click time that way, one could alter the fees. And I'm just raising the issue of do we need to consider or at least note here that perhaps there needs to be some consideration of abuse of registrants in addition to the abuse of claimants. It's a bit late in our process to come up with a solution, but should we not?
I think it's very late. I think that's the subject of a separate statement, if you wish. Konstantinos.
Yes, I really do not understand what Alan means, because the registrant cannot really abuse the system. The registrant cannot initiate a complaint in any case. So if there is an abuse of registration, the URS will deal with it, and the registrant will lose the domain name because it will be suspended. I mean, I think that is enough. I don't really understand how a registrant can abuse the URS, considering the fact that he cannot even initiate a complaint.
Yeah, that makes good sense to me. Thank you. I think we can move along to the review of the URS and UDRP. I don't think we have a full consensus on this. Would anyone like to?
Dave, I have a question. David, I have a question for you. Sorry to go back to the abusive process issue. We were trying to make sure we understood it. Could you repeat what this?
I believe the consensus is the statement as it's put out there on the left hand.
Okay, so no change to the straw man language.
That's right.
That's right.
Thanks.
Zahid, you had your hand up.
Yeah, thank you. Sorry, just referring to the point that you just went forward, I was taking my time to go through the nominate thing that Konstantinos is well aware of, and we discussed this on our call earlier. There is a provision for abusive registration if the complainant proves the respondent has been found to have made an abusive registration in 3 or more DRS cases. So there is a 3-strikes-you're-out provision in the nominate one, which the NCSG actually sort of seems to be okay with, and that may be something we could emulate in this. I'd just like to put it out there.
Konstantinos.
I think, yes, there is a provision like that, but I think that it is a separate issue. I think that this provision refers to cyber squatting, which in any case it is tackled within the URS. So if you have a registrant that is registering abusive domain names over and over and over again, like the famous Toppen registrant, then yes, I mean, we are talking about serial cyber squatting, and I think we have incorporated, and correct me if I'm wrong.
And so could we put that into the evidence of abuse, and so create a presumption against the respondent then?
I'm not sure I understand that.
Create a provision, basically just copy-pasting this in to some extent, saying that if the complainant can show that this is a repeat offender, then the presumption of abusive registration would be held against him. And so the burden actually is on the respondent to show he was not abusive. This is what the nominate thing says.
Any comment on that? Robin.
Yeah, this seems a little late in the game to be adding these kinds of provisions. I mean, that seems a bit extreme of a remedy from my standpoint.
Yeah, I think that is a really a whole new subject. I don't think we should let that upset the consensus we already have, and I suggest that that be a separate subject of separate comment. Well, seeing no hands raised, I think we come finally to the review process. We have the straw man mandatory review, no sunset requirement to publish statistics. Are there any comments on this? Kathy.
Would it be appropriate to all to add some kind of hopeful language that in the future the URS and the UDRP will be reviewed together and perhaps integrated into a single policy?
Any comments on that? Mark? Mark, go ahead.
I'm sorry, I was on mute. I'm reluctant to have that put on the table now. We've
okay.
had further talk earlier about how it really tying this to the UDRP review is outside the scope of this process, and you know would more appropriately be raised separately. And I think that's where we ought to remain.
Yeah, I have some concerns speaking personally that. Trying to mix the URS and the UDRP at this point is very premature. We know that the UDRP itself is trying to initiate a new procedure. We are not sure what that's going to look like. Alan, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, short of the board making the decision to initiate a PDP on the UDRP, there really is no process other than the GNSO deciding, and the threshold for the a stakeholder group to initiate that kind of thing is pretty low. I really don't think it's within our mandate to make this recommendation here.
Okay.
If Kathy is agreeable with that.
That's fine. Thanks for the discussion.
No, thank you. I don't see any other hands raised, and Kathy.
There is one more issue. Is it timely and appropriate to
mandatory.
Have to issue number one?
Mandatory, you're right. Pardon me. Okay, going back to the mandatory issue. Kathy, do you want to speak your piece?
I do. I wanted to thank everyone across all of these weeks and all of these discussions for the extensive consideration of our concerns, of NCSG's concerns. We really believe that a considerable amount of fairness and balance and due process has now been built into this rapid response system, into this URS, and we will vote for mandatory.
Well, thank you. Any other comments? I see no hands raised. I see the chat room has says hooray, and the BC thanks you. The chair thanks you. I think we can declare victory. Does anyone else have any other issues to raise or questions, comments?
Is there any merit in talking about course clearinghouse issues now, or do we just want to go home for the weekend
and leave Margie to
her writing?
Yeah, I think we've closed the book temporarily on the clearinghouse. Okay. Thank you all.
Go
ahead.
Before we close, so I'm drafting. I'm going to send it out in sections since I started on the clearinghouse first. When I finish that, I'll send that to you guys. One question I do have, though, I know we asked this yesterday, but do we not want to schedule any calls for next week, or do you just assume that we'll do everything online and you'll, if we need a call, we'll set up a doodle next week?
Well, my preference was for doing this by email unless it appears that there is something to be accomplished by further calls. I think we should leave that to next week. I'd rather see your draft report before making a decision on that.
Okay.
Okay. Well, in that case, again, thank you.
Thank you, David.
Thank you very much, David. Thank you all.
Daddy.
And
thanks, David.